Okay, we're ready to begin. I want to welcome everybody to Parshat HaShavuos here. If you have any questions, please, you feel free to interrupt, to send me a chat, or if you'd like to actually talk, you can just let me know. But anyways, hope all are well, and for those who live in Toronto are enjoying our lovely weather. Okay, we'll start on Chai Sarah. So I'll begin by saying the famous idea of the Rav Soloveitchik has really a very beautiful idea, and I will be unable to say it as beautifully as he could. If you'd like to, I believe the audio is available on the Bergen County Beit Midrash site, and it's about a 2.5 hour shiur, but it's well worth listening to. But anyway, the Rav begins, of course, with the famous Rashi, the beginning of the Parsha, that Tzara was Mea Shana, Esrim Shana, and Sheva Shani. Why she lived 100 years, 20 years, and 7 years. And then the Pasuk repeats, Shnei Chaye Tzara. These are the years of Tzara, which Rashi says they were all good years. And the Rav notes that this one Pasuk encapsulates the life of Tzara. How Tzara was a 7-year-old, a 20-year-old, and a 100-year-old throughout her life. The Rav explained that as we go through life, we go through different stages. The innocence of youth, the strength of the innocence of childhood, the strength of youth, our maturity of old age. And usually we live them one after another. We go through one stage and we move on to another stage, to another stage. The Rav said that Tzara lived all three stages at the same time. Very often, the beautiful innocence of young children is lost as we mature and get into a cynical world. We lose that. And Tzara managed to maintain her innocence, her vigor, even into her old age. And conversely, we know how young people don't have the maturation, the ability, the analysis that you only go and develop as an adult. And of course, the greatness of Tzara, she has them in her childhood throughout her life. She lived these three stages as one. And the Rav goes on to say, what I'm summarizing in 3 minutes, he developed for a long, long time, that basically he explained this, he developed this concept on Tefillah and Talmud Torah, how these two mitzvot in many ways are contradictory. And what I mean by that in order to pray, you have to be like a child, because a prayer is total dependence on another. Just like an infant cries out to God, and prayer is crying, so the mother knows what they have to do. It's that total dependence the child has on a parent. When an adult is sophisticated, and we know cause and effect, and we can explain, maybe now in the stock market, we don't know, so we can pray a little more. But basically, when adults are too sophisticated to pray, and that's really one of the reasons why modern man finds prayer so difficult. So you have to have the attitude of a child, the total dependence on another. And of course, to learn, you have to have the sophistication of an adult. A child cannot learn. As the Rav put it in his lecture, in his talk, just to say how my teacher says something and therefore you accept that isn't learning. That's not learning. Learning is the challenge to analyze, debate, and discuss. And that requires an adult mind. And therefore, it's very difficult. These two don't go together. And that's why the Hasidic world emphasized prayer. The Misnagdish world emphasized, learning. But Tzara had both at the same time. That's how the Rav developed the whole theme. Tzara had both ideas, the ability to have the childhood and the adult throughout her life. Anyways, that's in a nutshell. I just thought it's a beautiful idea to mention. The Rav explained on who Tzara was. Of course, Tzara was Avraham's husband, and we know that God's covenant with the Jewish people was not made to Avraham alone. That's the Rav also develops this idea, but rather it was a covenant made to Abraham and Sarah and Yitzchak and Rivka and Yaakov and Leah and Rachel. It was done to the pairs, and that's why after Tzara dies, basically, Abraham fades from the picture. Abraham was 137, I guess, so he lived to be 175. He lived, another 43 years or later. So, but yet, the Torah records records like nothing of his later lives except the marriage of Yitzchak, which is the continuation of our Masorah, and his death. But basically, the Torah tells us almost nothing about the later years of Avram's life, just like it tells us basically nothing about the earlier years of Avram's life. We know Avram really for a relatively, you know, short period of time. We meet him at 75. We don't know what caused him to reach out to God. All the midrashim were taught in kindergarten are nowhere to be found in the Chumash, and because it's not important how Avraham found God. So we meet Avraham as an adult, and of course once his wife passes away, we no longer really hear from Avraham anymore. We move on to the next stage. Then of course we have in the next pasuk the famous the question everybody asks, Vayavo Avraham lispot l'Sarah b'lifkotah, and Avraham came to eulogize, you know, Sarah and to cry for her. So the Meforshim all point out, or many point out, that this course is backwards. Usually when somebody dies, you cry first. The pain of a person cries, and only afterwards, when you sort of have calmed down and have time to compose oneself, can you say a eulogy. Whatever, a month later, you need time. When a person is crying, you cannot say a eulogy. So why here does the pasuk say that first he eulogized her and then he cried? So the Rav develops also, and the other people develop the idea that basically when a person dies, one cries because there can be a tragedy. When there's a tragic death, one is crying over a tragedy. But with the Avod and Imad, with here in Avram and Sarah, Sarah lived a full life. Mea Shana, Eshim Shana, Besheva Shana, and she lived a complete full life. There was not the tragedy. Death is part of the cycle of life. God has created death as part of our life cycle. So there was no tragedy on that level. However, the tragedy is the loss of the wonderful person, the loss of the ability to connect to someone who's in the Masorah. So when you understand the wonderful aspects of the person, then you realize the loss not as a personal tragedy, but it's a tragedy of the Jewish people. So it's after the hesped, after one begins to eulogize and to speak the unique qualities of the person, then of course you cry more because you realize the loss is even more. It's interesting. I was just listening this week, Rav Schechter, one of his talks on Chayesar, and he actually mentioned how his father had passed away about, I think, a little over a year ago. He was 94, and he said that the way it was very interesting how he put it. Wasn't really a tragedy. He wasn't well. He was 94. He lived a long life. That was it. They did an operation. He wasn't well, and he knew the operation might not work. It didn't work. But he said since his father had passed away, people had spoken to him and told him all the wonderful things. Those who don't know, his father was a member of the Beit Din of the RCA, what did a lot of the Gittin and everything. The famous story at the Bar Mitzvah, Rav Herschel Schechter, his father got up and said, now Rav Herschel is known as my son, but one day I'm sure I'll be known as his father. And of course, the father is Baruch Hashem, my Rebbe, and quite, the preeminent postmate perhaps in the modern Orthodox world. But he said, but after all the people told him the wonderful qualities of his father, he felt, in a sense, like more sad, what was missing. So that's the element of Avraham crying only after the hesped for Sarah. Okay, now that's just the introduction. We'll spend a few minutes on the bulk of the parsha, of course, the finding of a wife for Yitzchak. So everyone knows the problem is why is the Torah spend, 67 long repetitive verses, tells the exact same story twice with minor variations. And we know so many important things in the Torah barely get half a verse. And of course, our sages comment, Yafeh sichatan shel avdei avot, the casual discussions of the servants of our patriarchs and matriarchs are more valuable than the laws. That's the essence what all of the book of Bereshit is about. We don't, why not start the Torah, as Rashi says, and Shmot, the book of laws, this is what you do, this is what you don't do. That's not the essence of Torah. They'll fill in the details. Those are the spine of the Torah, but the flesh, the heart of the Torah are the stories, the values, what we live, and that's what all aberration is all about. So the laws, we live, of course, in a generation with a lot of emphasis on halakha, which is very nice, but sometimes and often comes at the expense of some of the other aspects of Judaism. So we have 67 psukim to tell us the casual discussions one can learn a lot more, and we'll point out a few of the things perhaps we can learn from the casual discussion. So they said a lot. What do we learn from that? But that's really the essence of the parsha. So I'll start by perhaps something. This is pointed out at least by the Beis Halevi, Rav Soloveitchik's great grandfather, and who he's named after, and I believe Yoshim Shem Rafael Hirsch points this out, and then Siv has it in a slightly different context. They basically, what the Mefarshim do is they look for all the differences in the stories. And I remember when I had the pleasure being in the Chama Leibowitz's, shiur for a year when I was in Gruss. So we went through this, and there are like 20 differences. You drew them on each side of the paper, the original story and how the story is told over. Little nuances that we don't have time now to get into. If you look in the Chumash and you put the two stories next to each other, you'll see many of the differences. And then that's how you begin to see the beauty of, first of all, the servant of Abraham in the way he changed the story. In marketing, that's what he was doing. He was basically on a marketing mission to find a wife for Abraham, and it wasn't so easy. Abraham was all nervous. He made him take a shvu, I made him promise, and he said, what if I don't find anybody? It was not at all a foregone conclusion that he was going to find a wife for Abraham, an appropriate wife. So he had a seller. He had to sell the story. So any good salesman, you don't lie, but you emphasize those points that are important for those people. So, for example, it's one of the obvious things is when he gets into the house of Lavan and Betuel. So the first thing he talks about is how wealthy Abraham is. He recognized already. It didn't take long to tell that Lavan was very materialistic. And he ran after him, and the comment of our sage, because he saw the gold and the silver, and he thought, what can he get? That's actually in the Chumash. He saw, so he emphasizes the wealth, which is not so emphasized as much by Abraham. And he downplays the notion of God a little bit. That wouldn't sell over too well, et cetera, et cetera. Many of the changes. So I just want to point out in slightly more detail, I'll point out one of the changes. So when we begin, so what does Abraham say? So Abraham says, go find a daughter. Lo tikach ishel livni mizot haknani. Don't take from the people here in Knan. We'll get back to that later. Velakachta ishel livni liyitzchak. Take a wife for my son, for Yitzchak. Very nice. Okay, that's what, of course, his mission. When the servant goes, so he says, he discusses that, he mentions that he has to take lo tichak isha livni, livnot haknani. When he repeats the instruction of Abraham, he says that my master made me swear, lo tichak isha livni, livnot haknani, do not take a woman for my son. But what is missing is livni li Yitzchak, for my son, for Yitzchak. When Abraham gave the instructions, he said, don't take from Knan for my son, for Yitzchak. But the servant only said, for my son. What happened here to Yitzchak? So I think most of us reading it would not really pay too much attention. That's just a manner of speech. In fact, I believe that even Ezra is not any of the changes. He just says that's when people speak. If you tell a story twice, you're not going to say the words exactly the same. Even if you have a photographic memory, the nuances of speech are such that there are going to be variations. So many of them, unfortunately, don't even pay any attention. They're not troubled. And by the way, in general, I think we were all brought up with the notion that every single word in the Chumash is important. Of course it's important, but to focus on the different nuances in every word, and not everybody agreed with that approach. Divrei Torah kelshon b'nei adam. Sometimes the extra words is just a manner of speech, and it doesn't really reflect deeper ideas. So that's one aspect. So anyway, so he says, So it's missing. The Yitzchak is missing, but the approach we're taking, where every word is very important, so what exactly does he mean? Why is it missing? So this, I mentioned, Rav Hirsch Beit Halevi points out, is really, if you look at the marriage, and then the Nesif has this later on, if you look at the marriage of Yitzchak and Rivka, they were two wonderful people, but it really, I don't know how to say this in a nice way, but it really wasn't such a great marriage. As we know, we don't know exactly how old Rivka was, but we know she was, you know, quite young. I know you learned in kindergarten she was 3, but whatever, 3, 14, however old she was young. Yitzchak, we know how old he was, in the Torah, 40. He's much older than her. And they came from totally different worlds. Yitzchak was on the Akedah. He was willing to sacrifice himself. Totally, totally different family structure, background, culture, everything was different. And it's very difficult to merge those two ideas. And it really never merged. We know that Yitzchak and Rivka never spoke to each other. At least, I'm sure they spoke to each other. The Chumash never records them speaking to each other. The Chumash only tells us what's important. They didn't discuss. So when the Chumash tells us that Avraham went to tell Sarah to make the cake and everything for the Malachim, so that's an important aspect. Why does the Torah have to tell us that? And the Torah doesn't tell us anything like that, what the day-to-day conversations of Yitzchak and Rivka. Just when Yaakov was leaving, that was the only time they spoke to each other. Katsi b'chayem is made in a chet, only in a very sort of negative way. The end, next week, like Parsha, that's the only conversation recorded. The problems they have with Yaakov and Esav, the Torah never records them speaking about it, which probably explains why each one had a very different attitude, how to bring up their kids, and that's where Parsha develops. That was the fatal flaw they made, that each parent had a favorite, and they brought up their children in a different way, and that if you don't talk to each other, that is going to happen. So that's what the Beit Halevi points out. So when Abraham told the servant to go find somebody, he said, "Leave me, Yitzchak, for my son." That's meaning a person who is appropriate to continue the Mesorah of the Jewish people. A matriarch of the Jewish people. We need a balat chesed, a righteous woman, a caring woman, who will be the link into the future of the Jewish people. But in addition to Livni, a person who is worthy to be for my son, the son of the Jewish people, it's got to be Yitzchak. Yitzchak has a unique personality, a very difficult upbringing in many ways, and therefore he needs a wife who is especially attuned for him. And the servant just said, "I'm looking for a son, a daughter, Livni, for one who's appropriate to be the daughter, the son-in-law of Abraham." He found that. She is very appropriate to be the daughter-in-law of Abraham, but she's not as appropriate to be the wife of Yitzchak. And that little nuance from that one little word that the Torah leaves out when it says, Livni Yitzchak. The Nesiv actually points out, you know, the end of the story, so Yitzchak is coming from Be'er Lachai Ro'is, which our sages say he was davening mincha, just before you get married, whatever, he was all nervous, and Rivka saw him coming, and she fell off the camel, and she said, "Who is this guy?" I mean, obviously, it's clear that Rivka was, like, blown away. Mi ha'ish ha'lazeh ha'yaholech, but who is this man? Probably had a long beard, he probably looked his penetrating eyes, probably which the Medr says, of course, the eyes, what happened to them on the altar. So clearly something is, it blew Rivka away. So what did she do? Vayomer Evet, who I don't need, this is your master, this is your husband. Vatikach, I don't know if it means master, what Adoni, Vatikach Hatsif, Vatikach. She took her, what's the translation? Not her kerchief, her took her covering, and she covered her face. She covered her face. And then the Tzif points out, what does that mean? This is that Rivka was basically in awe of Yitzchak. I mean, what's not to be in awe of? He was an unbelievable tzaddik, a person willing to give up his life, and she had never met somebody like that, where she came from. So she covered her face. She, to be in the presence of such holiness, she didn't feel, you know, she couldn't tell Yitzchak to take out the garbage and to do all the other things that a wife has to tell a husband to do occasionally. That wasn't, she wasn't going to tell somebody who was such a holy person. She was afraid of him. And then the Tzif points out, having fear for your parents, that's the mitzvah in the Torah. having fear of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's a mitzvah in the Torah. But to have fear of a spouse, that's not a mitzvah in the Torah. That's no relationship that one can have. And that sort of, Rivka was always afraid to challenge, like Yitzchak, on the raising of her of the children. That's why they went the separate. It's a very, I mean, the true matter, I know this is maybe as in certain ways sounds almost heretical, and this is really the different approaches you take to learning the Chumash, but it seems to be the simple meaning of the Chumash. It's very hard to argue on it, and this is not my thoughts. These are thoughts of our great commentaries pointing out what is rather obvious, and of course which are model lessons for us. As a matter of fact, we know that the Gemara says, V'ahavta l'reicha kamocha, the mitzvah to love your neighbor as yourself is primarily towards a wife, towards a spouse. In other words, even though the Torah phrases it for everybody, and of course it does apply to everybody, the aspect of the mitzvah, the key aspect of the mitzvah is towards a wife. So that's the relationship of the spouse has to be one of love, not one of fear, and that component was somehow missing in the relationship between Yitzchak and Rivka. She was the perfect person Livni, but she was not necessarily the perfect person Liyitzchak. I'll point out, as I'm sure you may have noticed already, that every time I refer to the servant going to do his job, I never mention his name, Eliezer. Everybody knows that it's Eliezer who went to find the wife. How do we know it's Eliezer? We'll see who's listening. Who wants? If you can type in the chat box. How do we know it's Eliezer who went to do the job for Abraham? Why didn't Abraham do it himself? Mitzvah bo yoter mi b'shlucho. It's always a mitzvah to do something yourself. Why didn't he marry off his daughter? It's one of the few obligations on a parent. The Gemara says there are very few obligations on a parent to a child, but one of them is to marry them off. So he did, of course, but we know that there's always a mitzvah to a greater yourself. Why did he appoint a shaliach? Okay, no one answers, no one wants. Okay, so here so the truth of the matter is you don't know, because the Torah never tells us. The Torah never tells us who the person who carried out the task of Avraham was. And if you look, you know, carefully in the Chumash, or not so carefully, if you just like pay attention, you'll notice he's referred to as either Ha'eved or Ish. Either when the Torah begins, so Avraham calls Abdo the Kan Beito, his servant, the master of his house, and he tells the Eved, Vayomer Eved, so he's Eved. Except that when he's in the context of Abraham, and when he's in the context of Laban, he's known as the Ish. In other words, the Eliezer totally gave up of himself. He sought no personal glory. He was carrying out the mission as Eved Abraham. That's who he was. He totally gave up his identity. But when he's in the context of Laban and Betuel, then he's Ish. We know in the Torah the word Ish always represents a person of great importance. Hanashim, even on the Meraglim, that's what we know. The Meraglim were initially great people. The word Ish is a person of dignity. But his name is never mentioned, because he totally gave up of himself to complete his task. And that, of course, is one of the famous, I think this is a famous idea, one of the four shalshelets in all of Chumash. So there are only four of those in all of Chumash, and of course the sound of the shalshelet. We know the Tamei HaMikra, those of you who were in Rabbi Moshe Rosenberg's classes, we have them on the MP3s. He gave the Shirim on Tamei HaMikra, which some views in the Talmud claim are Sinai Edik, are Misinai. That's the first commentary in the Chumash, the Tamei HaMikra. That's maybe the first Perush on Chumash. So the shalshelet, as you all can hear and you all know, is the sound of hesitation, of tremendous hesitation, and it only appears, you know, four times in Chumash. Once last week by Lot, he didn't want to leave, you know, his money was there, you know, people don't want to leave their money behind, and when Eliezer, now we can call him Eliezer, but the Ish Eved Avram, when he was about to make his condition, the girl who comes out, who does this, and you know, with all the water, So he hesitated. He hesitated for him. Why did he hesitate? So Chazal say, because he had his own daughter. What does Avraham have to schlep around the world? He's a faithful servant. Avraham appointing him on such an important mission. Obviously, Avraham trusted a lot. He trusts him so much, so why not marry his own daughter? He had his own daughter, so he kind of wanted to fail. That's how, apparently, what the rabbis are saying. He really wanted to fail, so he paused. Should I really go through with this? And he went through. He hesitated. Of course, that's the other famous, the Shalshel, the other two, just to mention, are, of course, and anyone know where the other two are? You wanna type them in? Nobody knows. Okay. No one knows. Okay. So, the other one, it's interesting, three of the four are in Bereshit by Yosef and Eshet Potiphar. When he, goes back, and he tarried, he wasn't sure. He was on the verge, as we know, the famous, like, measure, still he saw the image of his father. He was about to sin with, you know, Eshet Potiphar. There was a hesitation. It wasn't like he ran away like that. And the fourth one, which is the harder one, that's in Parshat Tzav, I believe, by Aaron. When Moshe is told to anoint Aaron as the Kohen Gadol, we know from many sources Moshe, like most great leaders, Moshe is the greatest of leaders, but most great leaders don't like to share, like, leadership. One of the hardest things of being a leader is to share. Because usually you feel, and you're usually right, you can do it better than anybody else. That's why you're the leader of the company, because you can do it better than anybody else. So why should I delegate to other people, let other people? Moshe wanted to be the Kohen Gadol also. So before he appointed Aaron, there was this slight hesitation. Of course, in each one of the four cases in the Chumash, the person did what was right. And of course, in the Chumash, you can't tell. It's just the parshanut of the Tamei HaMikra, but putting on that sound, the shalshel, the climbing ladder, going up and down. So that's, here you hear. So that's why, but Eliezer overcame that, and he totally gave up himself, and that's why his name is not mentioned at all. I see Bella saying he seems to be Avram's only servant. I don't know about that. What about Mamre Eshkol? The Torah mentions all kinds of people who were with Avram, and we don't really know too much about Eliezer from other places. We know he had Lot, everything, but the Torah does not talk too much about him. Yishmael doesn't really talk about him, and it mentions other people around Avram. So I don't know. I don't know if that is the only one. It could be another person he appointed. I think, of course, it's a deliberate attempt, and even if it is, why not mention the name? We know mentioning a name gives somebody importance. That's name MP. We know in psychology, you want to get somebody's attention, you call by their name. Everybody knows if you're in a noisy room and your name is at the other end of the room, your ear somehow picks it up. So the fact that the Torah left out his name on purpose, it, of course, plays into this idea of him totally giving up himself. And that's why we know, everybody knows how important names are in the Bible. And names are probably not even, I don't know, have their real names. You know, even Lavan. What's Lavan's name? Which maybe will, you know, what does it mean? White, purity. That doesn't seem to be so appropriate. Which maybe will lead us to the next comment I'll make. The next notion of the story. The other question people ask is, why does Avraham have to extend his servant halfway around the world to find a wife for Yitzchak? He was nervous. The people in Canaan, they worship idols and they're not great people. Okay, he doesn't want them. I understand. Dude, did he find anybody any better? He didn't find anybody who was so great. Halfway around the world. She was, but her family wasn't. I presume it's not. There were other women who were also equally wonderful women. So the simple reading, and some of them Parshim say, is obviously, if he didn't want the in-laws around. Yitzchak didn't want the Mechatanim around to mess up, and we know how difficult it was. So where Avram was Avram and Ifri, they were carrying this message. And clearly they were looking for a daughter who didn't follow the parents', you know, footsteps. So it's much easier to take the girl out of her surroundings. Had Yitzchak married somebody local, so he would have had to go to their house for, the Avodah Zarah parties and all the other things, have to go to the in-laws. That's the simple shot, that it was easier to influence that to take her out of the neighborhood. But the run, And the other, I also think, you know, Shimon Peres have a very fascinating, very important comments. We have to see how it applies here. But they make a comment that Einachinami, that the people in Canaan and the people where Avram came from, both were Oved Avodah Zarah. That's if Avram was, we know, he left his homeland because they were Oved Avodah Zarah. All the Midrashim on smashing the idols shows their idolatry that they had. So that's what Canaan, they were like Canaan, they all worshipped idols. What's the difference? So we know there's a pasuk in Chumash and Achrimot. We read it, the introduction to the laning at Mincha on Yom Kippur. Kemasei Eretz Mitzrayim, Asher Batam Misham, Yatzatam Misham, Kemasei Eretz Canaan. You should not copy the ways of the Egyptians and the ways of the Canaanites, of the Canaanites. Apparently, there was a moral degradation. Their character was flawed in Canaan. It wasn't just a question of idolatry. It was a question of character. And the Ram makes a very, very beautiful point that idolatry, is an intellectual error. Person believes in many gods or no gods or different understanding of God. That doesn't mean the person's a bad person. It's a very serious flaw from our point of view. But it's an intellectual flaw. It's a flaw that you can argue with someone and demonstrate. A character flaw is the essence of the person. And we know the character is what gets passed on more from the parent to a child. The belief system very often is not necessarily, you know, children go to university, they have a different educational path, a different type of a surrounding, that they can change from their parents. But the character, it's in our genes to a certain degree, culture, nurture, nature, whatever, but it's clearly part of our genetic makeup. So that's what Avram said. Both people, I'm taking them from families that are Oved Avodah Zarah, but at least if I go back to where I come from, they don't have that extra, the corruption of character. So it's a very beautiful idea, I think. The only problem is, I don't know, it doesn't seem to be true. The people, Lavan and Bethuel, who we really don't know anything about, except that Rashi says, the quote, that he wanted to prevent all things, so he died, he was killed. Okay, so he wasn't such a tzaddik either. We know Lavan, Bikesh, Lakor, Tekol, he's worse than Paro. So, and we don't think of Lavan being so terrible as Oved Avodah Zarah. We think of his character flaw. So the whole essence, the whole argument, I think what he's saying is true, but it seems, you know, difficult to apply in this case. So I have to try to answer. So I would say that, so this gets into Lavan's name. What does Lavan mean, white? Lavan was, you know, I don't know what the word for it. He was like, he didn't do anything. He was like technically a tzaddik. Lavan didn't do anything wrong. What does he say? He says, for example, when he tricks Yaakov with who to marry. So lo yaseh came in komenu latet hatzirah name before. This is immoral. Lavan pretends to be white, pure. I must say, it's very embarrassing to the older sister to marry off the younger sister first. I don't have to tell you, in many circles, this is, to this day, this is an issue, whether the older sister can get married before the younger sister. Rav Moshe has a tshuva about it, actually. He says, nothing doing. If the younger sister is ready to get married, why should she not do a mitzvah just because her older sister isn't married? One has nothing to do with the other, and you let her get married. You don't wait for older sisters. But, okay, we know that not everybody follows that. It sounds very firm. Lavan was very, and that's really what his name was. And I think that's the Haggadah of Bikesh Lakor at HaKol, that Lavan, in a certain sense, was worse than Paro, is really emphasizing this, that on the surface, Lavan wasn't so bad. He welcomed him into his home. He did many wonderful things. He did give him a place to stay. So on the surface, but we all know that's more dangerous. The enemy who stabs us in our heart is less threatening than the one who stabs us in our back. So in a certain sense, perhaps that's a little bit to say maybe the character, but that character is worse. But the point of the force make, I think, is a very beautiful idea, that character is much more important than the belief system of a person. That can always change. That can always be taught. And even if it doesn't change, that's not that doesn't reflect on the nature of the person. We know there are many people who are I don't know, who idol worshippers, let's say, can be wonderful people. Having a good character is not dependent only on if you're, for sure not dependent if you are Jewish or not, dependent on your system of life. So that's one other thing why he, why Avraham had to go all the way around the world. Besides the simple pshat to take Rivka out of her environment, to go there. Okay, we'll just maybe say one more idea, and then we'll give sort of a wrap up. I don't know if any questions. I'll pause for half a minute, and if anybody wants to type in any questions, no, anybody. Okay. So the famous, you know, pasuk at the end of the parsha. So we talked about Rivka falls off the camel. As she falls off the camel, she covers her face. It's too much. She's like blown away. So it says, "Vayikachet Rivka vatilo lisha." So he took Vayaviha Yitzchakola Asarimo. It's very, also very beautiful, sad pasuk. And Yitzchak took her to the tent of his mother. His mother had died 3 years earlier. Vayikach et Rivka, he took Rivka v'tilo Elisha, and she was his wife. Vayeha veha, and he loved her. Vayach en Yitzchak acharimo, and Yitzchak was comforted for his mother. So we know that, you know, the beginning of the Parsha, we didn't talk about that, the burial of Sarah. But what is fascinating, of course, is Yitzchak is nowhere to be found. Why wasn't Yitzchak at his mother's funeral? By Yavo Avram, there's a whole debate in the Mefarshim, where exactly did they go, and of course, did Sarah die right after the Akedah? That's the whole, from the Psukim, it follows right after the Akedah, and Rashi, of course, quotes the famous Medrash. She heard about the Akedah, had a heart attack, and died. But many people assume not so, that she didn't necessarily die after the Akedah. So where exactly was Avraham coming from? But whatever, if Avraham could have traveled to the funeral, so surely Yitzchak could have come. Yitzchak isn't at the funeral. Very strange. I don't really have a clear answer why that is so. But it's clear that Yitzchak apparently never properly mourned for his mother. And we know that's the problem that, you know, Yaakov had. The reason he couldn't gain any comfort for what he thought that Yosef had died was because Chazal said, we know that psychologically you cannot be comforted if you don't know. That's the tragedy in Israel on the missing soldiers. It's much more tragic, we know, even in a dead soldier. Dead soldier is very tragic, but you can get a sense, a little bit of comfort. A missing soldier you can never have comfort from. So that was, in a certain sense, Yitzchak missed the opportunity to mourn for his mother. And he only got that opportunity really later on, perhaps when Rivka came into the house. And that's why now the Torah finally tells us, when he finds a wife to replace, in a certain sense, not to replace, but to move on in a new stage of life, he gained comfort. That's one half of the pasuk. But the other half, which maybe you heard a shmooze in yeshiva or something, so it says, Vayikachet Rivka, he took her for a wife, and then he loved her. You know, so you mean love is only after marriage, you shouldn't date, you know, the whole thing. You first you marry somebody, and then you love them. So everybody, that's true. In a good marriage, the love grows after marriage. But, and that's one model. We discussed already, and if you're going to go along the lines of the Netziv, that the marriage of Yitzchak and Rivka had huge communication gaps, and it's clear they weren't talking to each other, so it's not such a great proof that this is what one should do. First get married and then love her. In other words, there clear seems to be a lack of familiarity with each other. They got to know each other, and then they loved each other, but there were issues. Of course, the other model, and of course, the reason the Torah is doing this, I believe, is because, like usual, there's no one model how to do things, especially in the value system. You know, there's a... In halacha, there is arguments in halacha, but there's basically everybody has to eat the same matzah and the same lulav, and you know, and the davening is all the same, more or less. But in attitudes, we're very different. Everybody thinks differently. That's why the Talmud says you have to make a bracha when you see a large multitude of Jews, because everybody is different. We here the Torah is presenting the model of marriage. of love developing after marriage. And of course, in the next generation with Yaakov, the Torah presents the model of love before marriage. So that's the whole story, that he's going to work all these years because he was so in love with, like, you know, Rachel. So the Torah is presenting two models of marriage. Which one is right? Depends on the situation, depends on the time. Perhaps for a person like Yitzchak with the Akedah, that model is more appropriate. For someone like Yaakov, who had different, you know, the rough and tumble with Esav, and he was already much older when he got married, even than his father, it was a whole different approach to marriage. So the Torah here presents two different approaches to marriage, and that's really how the parsha ends. Then just a short comment on the last line, the last section of the parsha. We mentioned Avram is not really mentioned after Sarah dies. He's remarried. Very difficult. What's the Torah telling us? Who is Keturah? But the bottom line is Abraham has six more children who can name 5 points if you can name two of the children that Abraham actually without looking. Okay, Tova, can you name? Can anybody name them? Without looking, I don't know that I could. Without looking in the Chumash, Medan, Midian, Yishbak, you know, people nobody ever heard of. And the Torah goes on to mention the six children of Abraham. Everybody says Abraham had two children, Yishmael and Yitzchak. That's in his middle age, whatever. But his elderly, at the beginning of old age, whatever, early retirement. In later retirement, Abraham had six more children. What happened to them? Nothing. Nothing. Abraham, 1 out of 8 children. You know, Yaakov, Yitzchak and Rivka, 1 out of 2, and only Yaakov, of course, gets them all. That's a whole other shear. But really, the Torah presents the other children to show that Abraham lived, but sort of not as part of our Masorah community. The same way we began, the Masorah was handed down, or Abraham and Sarah were the ones who gave it over together as a pair. Once Sarah left, whatever relations, whatever family Abraham with other people, that's not part of the Jewish people. That's a distinct aspect. And of course, a lot of people, you know, point out, then the Torah ends up with the children of Yishmael. That we actually have before, and we have this actually by the end of the Akedah. Actually, it's more noticeable there. By the end of the Akedah, so the Torah tells us, Nachor had 12 children. Utz, Buz, Kemuel, Aram, right, and then the birth of Rivka. So most people assume it's written to tell us that Rivka was born. That's the assumption that Rashi's making, or right, Rivka was born right after the Akedah, or at that point that the Torah is presenting the whole family really only for the purpose of Rivka. But if you look, there are eight children that he has through his wife, and 4 children that he has from his concubines. You know anybody else who had 8 children through his wife and 4 from his concubines? Sounds like a familiar story anywhere. So, you should know, can type in, right? So, here the Torah is clearly comparing and contrasting Yaakov, very good, thank you, to Nachor. They both had 12 children. They both had a similar style of children. In other words, the potential to be part of the Jewish people existed for many, many people. Nachum Liptak develops this theme at great length. Really, the book, Upper Reshit, is a theme of who's in and who's out of the Jewish people. Everybody could have been in. Lot could have been in, and he blew it, and Nachor's children, they all could have been in. And the Torah is paralleling. Look what these 12 children and those 12 children. And the Torah, and in every generation, some are in, some are out. And, of course, the book ends when Yaakov's 12 children all get in. And that's, you can, of course, explain that was really the fight, that the brothers thought that Yosef wanted to exclude his brothers from being part of Klal Yisrael. Now it becomes a much different fight than a fight over a coat and, the favoritism of the father becomes a fight for the legacy and the heritage of the father. The reunification is that all 12 can now be part of Christ. So now the book is over. Now we move into Shemot. So that's basically some of the ideas of Christ. So maybe we'll give a 90-second review. We began with the beautiful idea of the Rav. I highly recommend you listen to it on tape, how Sarah was a child a young adult, and a mature adult all at the same time, all three. She had the innocence of a child, the maturity of an adulthood throughout her life, and the notion of prayer and learning, the opposites, where you have to be a child dependent to pray and a sophisticated adult who cannot pray, and the reverse is true by learning. Sarah could do it it both. That's the Sarah who's Mea Shana, Esrim Shana, and Sheva Shanim. Then we spoke a little bit, or a lot of it, about the marriage of finding a wife for Yitzchak, how the servant's name is never mentioned because he totally gave up on himself. That's why we have a Shoshelet, Leave Me, Leave Yitzchak, that it wasn't enough to find a daughter-in-law for Abraham who could carry on the Masorah of the Jewish people. It had to be a wife for the unique qualities of Yitzchak, which is not easy to find. That's what the Nesiv and others like point out. There was, in a sense, that's why in the Chumash, in the first half, Avram says things to Yitzchak. The servant only says, leave me, not for Yitzchak. And that's why she covered her face. She was afraid, etc. There was this sort of inability to confront each other, which is inappropriate in a marriage, as appropriate as it may be in other types of relationships. In general, the long, long repetition, just to look at all the nuances in the difference, you see the beautiful aspect of the change of the emphasis on money to Lavan, and what he downplayed and upplayed. That's what the Torah is teaching us. The models of marriage, Yitzchak finding, you know, comfort from his wife, whether the love is before the marriage or after the marriage, and then really is before the introduction, but yeah, by Yishmael's, like children mentioned also, that everybody had the opportunity to be part of the Jewish people, but that's not the way it's worked out, and we move from the generation of Abraham and Sarah to the generation of Yitzchak and Rivka, which is next week. And okay, if there are any questions, otherwise we'll stop here and invite everybody. How do we know they had communication gaps? So, okay, we don't know exactly. The way we know is because there is no communication recorded in the Torah. Abraham and Sarah are talking to each other a lot. There's lots of conversation. And there's lots of conversation between Yaakov and Rachel, although they also have problems. You know, once Leah started having all the children, the conversations were not always very pleasant. Give me a child or I'm going to die. But the fact that the Torah doesn't record anything. She prayed in this corner, he prayed in that corner. He liked Esau, she liked, you know, Yaakov. It's clear there's no communication. And like usual, the Torah does not tell us things in a direct way. It's hinted, and you have to find it. The only time, there's only one pasuk that mentions any conversation. They mention that's the end of next week's parsha, Katzdi b'chayayim yitnei b'nei chayim, when they're sending him away for Yaakov, sending away from Esav. As a matter of fact, I'll say now for a minute, Beis Halevi has a beautiful idea. Vayetze Yaakov mi Beersheva vayelech Haranus. Everybody knows the famous thing, you know, when a tzaddik leaves an ear, Rashi quotes, the beauty leaves. So he explains a beautiful but sad idea, that when you leave the city, when you can be leaving for two reasons. You want to go somewhere else, or you want to leave where you are. You can make Aliyah because you want to leave, like, Russia, you know, 15 years ago to escape, or escape Yemen, wherever you're escaping from, or you're not really going to Israel. Israel is a place that will take you in. You're leaving where you are. Or you can leave America, North America. No one's leaving North America to go to Israel. They're going to Israel because of the beauty and the mitzvah to live in Israel. So some people are leaving. They're both leaving and going to Israel, but the motivation is totally different. So he says that was the problem. Yitzchak and Rivka have very different reasons why Yaakov had to leave. By Yetzer Yaakov mi Beersheba, that was Rivka. Because Rivka was afraid that Esav was going to kill Yaakov. So get out of here. Just wherever you have to run away, run away. By Yetzer Yaakov, get out. Where you go, I don't care where you go. Just get out of here. Yitzchak, of course, who would never anticipate Esav would kill Yaakov, he didn't have such a mindset. So Yitzchak said, go to Haran, find a wife. So in other words, the pasuk is not it's not the Rashi pshat, you know, the Hadith, Panaziva, Panahadra. It's again this total lack of completeness that Rivka sent, even when they're sending Yaakov away. You know, Rivka sending away to save his life, and Yaakov and Yitzchak to find a shidduch. So that's even there you can see this is the face of lady, then see, they all quote it, but you don't really, you need them, so I don't sound like an apikoros, so I need the cover of the face of lady and the Nesiv. I mean, but in essence, you know, if you're reading the Chumash, I think this is the simple, I'm not saying the only interpretation, but it's clearly a very valid interpretation. All right, any other questions? Okay, if there are no more questions, like Alan Bernstein tells me to write the Dvar Torah for Shabbos. Okay, Alan, I'll go write the Dvar Torah. And, okay, well, I wish everybody a good Shabbos. We'll resume with E-Team Sunday morning with Rabbi Heyman and Tzvi Grummet. Class is Rabbi Heyman on Gemara, Tzvi Grummet on the theology of Bereshit as a whole. And by the way, he's a computer-like master. So he does all these PowerPoint presentations in the middle and the highlighting. It's very cool. And whatever, I invite everybody to have be well and Shabbat Shalom and have a good night, everybody. Thank you. Thanks for listening.